Hello and welcome to Minor Recs. I'm Charlie. I'm joined today by Joel and Jamie and Natalie. And today we are going to be talking about the sitcom The Office. In general, we'll be talking about the American version, but it did start as a British show. We'll be talking and comparing those a little bit. If you're not familiar with The Office, it was created by Ricky Gervais and Stephen Merchant as a BBC show. It lasted for 2 seasons on BBC for a total of 12 episodes because British sitcoms tend to have very, very short runs. Quality over quantity, possibly. In 2005, it was developed for American television, and that version of The Office became sort of a runaway success, and I think kind of a pivotal show in sitcom history. So yeah, what's everyone's relationship with The Office? Did you watch it as it was first run on TV? Have you discovered it after the fact, streaming or on DVD?
For me, it was definitely streaming. I did binge it a lot. Once I started watching it, I was hooked. Like, even though people said that the first season wasn't as good, like, I still enjoyed it. But for me, the second season was the best. Yeah, I've been hooked ever since.
I came into it watching it live. I didn't watch the first season live, but I think the second season on NBC is when I started watching it. And then I started college in the fall of 2007. I remember The Office being like what everyone talked about, you know, it was just the show for everybody.
Yeah.
It definitely felt like it was part of a cultural moment, I think.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. Like between maybe 2008 and 2012, Thursday nights on NBC were just the place to be. Like it was The Office, then Parks and Rec, then Community, then 30 Rock. Mm-hmm. I remember so many nights when I would just laugh until I cried.
Well, for me, I've never watched a show where like they actually talk to the camera and like talk to the audience. So like I really like that aspect of it. So, and for me, it was just something that was like fresh and it was funny. So I really liked it.
When I first started working in an actual real office, like just before The Office came out, I was learning about real life office culture and then watching the parody of it on The Office, you know, and I dip into it. If I was around, I'd watch it. If I wasn't, I didn't, but I did appreciate the humor and I thought it was a fresh perspective as well.
How did real life office work hold up to The Office office work? Too many similarities for comfort.
Well, it's kind of funny because if you're not familiar with actual office culture, mm-hmm. you know, professional work culture, and just taking from the American perspective, some of the stuff might not be as funny, but mm-hmm. when you understand where the jokes are coming from and what, you know, just the kind of context behind the situation, it makes it that much more funny. Mm-hmm. It makes it relatable in a very day-to-day, moment-to-moment, I've been there a million times kind of way. For me, that's part of it, what makes it hilarious.
It makes me wonder about when my husband says that all his middle school students love The Office, and they're, you know, 12, 13. I'm like, do they get it? Like, they don't have any office experience, you know? So I wonder what they find humorous about it, or like what hits with them that makes it popular, you know, so many years later with middle schoolers.
Yeah, I think just like the awkward situations and like Michael Scott is so ridiculous, like as a boss and
his utter refusal to be perceived as anything else besides like the manliest you know, person ever and the greatest and the most bestest at everything he's ever done.
Yeah, the world's greatest boss.
Right. It's kind of a reflection of, we've seen other people in the public eye that act like that as mm-hmm. well, only in real life.
Yeah.
So it just kind of, it was just very interesting precursor to that.
Yeah, and I think that the character in the American show, Michael Scott, in the British show was Ricky Gervais's character, David Brent. And at one point in the British show, he says, I want to be a friend first and a boss second and an entertainer third. Mm-hmm. So he's got this very delusional sense of his own responsibility mm-hmm. and what's appropriate behavior for him. Mm-hmm. And I think that that was sort of a new thing for American sitcoms, because before The Office, there had been a couple of attempts at making Britcoms into American sitcoms, and they were such failures. I remember watching the American version of Men Behaving Badly, which lasted maybe a season. They tried to do Coupling, and that lasted a couple episodes. There were a couple of attempts at doing a Fawlty Towers American version, which were all so bad. John Cleese, the creator of Fawlty Towers, has suggested that the difference between American and British sitcoms at least at that time, is that British sitcoms have no problem making the protagonist unlikable. And American sitcoms, they kind of want to make everyone friendly and attractive and cuddly and someone that you can identify with. Mm-hmm. And that's not so much a priority in British television. So I think that's sort of an interesting way that this kind of diverges from previous sitcoms.
Yeah.
And another way I think that it's innovative for its time is there's no laugh track.
Yeah.
Thank goodness is what I have to say about that.
Yes. And I think, you know, new audiences have this aversion to laugh tracks mm-hmm. because it is an artificial, even if it's actually filmed in front of a live studio audience, mm-hmm. something about the psychological effect of being told what's funny, mm-hmm. being told when to laugh, is maybe a little offensive to us now or just unnatural.
Yeah.
And I think that having no laugh track in addition to the mockumentary mm-hmm. form of it, the camera people are supposed to be a documentary crew filming a documentary for some reason about this office.
Yeah, does anyone actually know the reason? I can't remember if they said it ever in the show.
They may have addressed it in the last season, but I don't remember a lot of the last yeah. season. I've blocked a little bit of it out.
Me too. Me too. It was not great. But yeah, no, that's a good point. For me, like the laugh tracks, like I grew up watching TV shows with laugh tracks. So like I got used to it. It was kind of like a comforting thing.
Yeah.
But then once I started watching The Office, like it was an adjustment. But like for me, it wasn't too bad. And I could like just easily just like get into it. So I think they did a really good job with it, to be honest.
Yeah, it changes the rhythm of the script, I think. Mm-hmm. Because if you think about classic sitcoms like The Golden Girls or Frasier or Friends, it's very joke-oriented. It's mm-hmm. very quick setup, quick punchline, laugh track, next joke.
Yeah.
And with The Office, there's very rarely direct punchlines.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like John Krasinski looking at the camera is a punchline. The rhythm of the show is different and more naturally funny. Like it's more observational and character-based rather than joke-based.
Well, in the camera setup, the fourth wall breakdown mm-hmm. really brings in the viewer.
Yeah.
And it really just kind of, it makes it so character, like just you're right in the room where everything happens. You're being talked to, literally, the actor is talking to you on your TV couch or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's a terrific way to personalize it.
Joel, you were mentioning before in another thing about being in the room where it happens when you're talking about, you know, political books and stuff like that. But I feel like it adds to this here, too, is that we become participants, you know, mm-hmm. we feel like we're in this office because everyone is kind of like an everyman, you know, also it's not, we often have these like soap opera type dramas and things like that, where everyone seems like really far away from our own lives. These are just like slightly caricatured, sometimes much more caricatured versions of regular people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, are there any times in the show where the camera is kept out?
They pushed the camera out specifically. I can't remember which scene it was, but I do remember, but they made like a show of it. Like, mm-hmm. we don't want you to come in here because mm-hmm. we're closing it off.
Yeah. Or like they'll close the blinds. Yeah. I remember yeah. from one episode. Yeah. But yeah.
And you'll see it through the window.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The episode where they... where Michael Scott and Dwight go to buy Michael Scott's condominium.
Mm-hmm.
And so the rest of the office holds like an Olympic day.
With the yogurt and, lids.
Yeah. Oh, man. But just made me laugh out loud, just the whole process of buying a house mm-hmm. and you don't want to sign. Like it was that complete buyer's anxiety of like, oh my gosh, is this like, are those termites under there? And like, what am I going to do? And put this weight upon my shoulders. But then the real estate agent is like, well, if you don't sign right now, you're going to lose $7,000. And the next thing is like, you know, that's not such a bad decision. They like didn't tell they bought the house. And but the point of that is like he had a really rough day because then he promises Dwight a room in the house so that he can get his rent. But then Dwight irritates him to the point where he revokes the invitation. So now he has like inter-workplace strife as well as buyer's anxiety, and he comes back to the office and Jim gives him a medal for buying the house, buying the condo. But I thought that was a great scene. Like even this unlikable character, there's some redeeming mm-hmm. aspect of him. There's some humanity, some emotion in there. You can tell he's got tears in his eyes and it really means a lot to him to have been awarded a gold medal, even though he doesn't know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
When he got back. So to me, that's like one of the moments where the camera really is great to be able to capture that particular I mean, obviously the camera's everywhere, but it's not just writing a comedy. It's also about portraying the comedy and how is it perceived through the lens, which I thought was great.
Yeah, because we see so many like side facial expressions, right? You know, that the people who are talking don't necessarily see. We see Stanley being like, you know, side-eyeing, or Jim always, you know? So it makes us feel like we're in on the in-joke every single time, even though the rest of the participants don't necessarily see all those things. Like, we can see it.
Or like Ryan's looks to the camera.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And I think that what you're saying, like them giving him a medal, is like what Charlie was talking before about how where it diverged from the British one, where even characters like Michael or Dwight, like, we do have empathy for them in certain situations, you know, we do see, like, you know, like you're saying, their humanity in a way that I did not feel in the British one.
And it could just be that they had that many more episodes, so the characters had no choice but to develop. But I do think that the strength of the American Office is largely from being an ensemble cast. There are so many different perspectives, and all of those actors are so good at being true to that character that even if you do see them in the background, the subtle things that they do are totally in keeping with what their character is supposed to be.
Yeah, and now whenever I see one of the ensemble cast members in something else, I'm always weirded out if they're not behaving,
it's,
you know,
so
like Angela. That's not what Angela would do, you know?
Right? Like, I heard she's a really nice person in real life, so it just... Yeah, it throws me off.
Now she and Jenna Fischer are doing a podcast called The Office Ladies.
Really?
Yeah, I think they're about 30 episodes deep, but every episode corresponds to an episode of The Office, and they'll just tell behind-the-scenes stories. It's very charming, but you definitely do get the sense that Jenna Fischer's a little bit like Pam, but Angela is nothing like Angela.
Yeah, she played it off so well. She's great as that character.
When I was rewatching the episodes for this, you know, in preparation for this podcast, it like tugged at my heart again, where I was like, we were talking a little bit before about how not everything carries, you know, a decade and a half later. But I think my feelings, I have like my nostalgia and just Jim's longing, which is so palpable in every episode and really was what kept me into the show, is it was Jim's longing.
That's what did it for me too. Like, that hooked me. I was just like, I need to see Jim and Pam together, like, make it happen.
I stopped watching when they got married. I think that was the very last episode I watched was their wedding. I was like, oh,
done.
They did it.
Yep.
I did out. It. Yeah.
I don't need to watch anymore.
Well, one of the episodes that I watched was when he was in the other office with Karen. And it kind of impressed me that he's able to build rapport so easily with someone, his character. And that made me just enjoy, like, he seems like you may not get a whole lot of work done if you worked with him, but he seemed like such a fun person to be around and to kind of have at your side. That was a great, great character.
Definitely.
Yeah, you got to have at least one character that you trust.
I'll tell you, though, that I think I've quoted Dwight the most out of any of the characters. Because I even taught my kids, like, do you have tickets? And then to what? The gun show, you know, and he, like, kisses each bicep. And just that kind of stuff cracks me up. And it might be the fact that I am from Pennsylvania. I am half Pennsylvania Dutch. And I kind of was fascinated how that was being portrayed into the show. You know, is this correct or not? And even when it wasn't, it was just so darn funny. You know, the beet farm and the whatever. Just Dwight's.
Such a unique character.
It was a very unique character.
Yeah.
And he was completely reliable on to provide laughs when he wasn't even smiling. And that takes some talent, I think.
So is the real life vibe of Scranton like the vibe in the show?
To be honest with you, I've never been to Scranton. So I come from Southeast Pennsylvania, and that's Northeast. So, but I have been to the collar counties of Scranton, like the coal country. And it's from what I see there, it's similar. It's just kind of a blue collar, just straight up kind of hard work in town.
Down to earth.
Yeah. It's, you know, like a small town city.
Yeah.
Really.
Going back to like the characters though, like I'm mentioning just like how they gave the characters like such good personality traits, like Kevin with like his band, and like you wouldn't think that like Kevin would be in this band, and you know, they made his character like funny but like with a personality too, and I think they did that for everyone, and they did just a really good job with it.
or just like people's arcs, like the rise and fall of Ryan the 10th. Mm-hmm. Like, just seeing.
Oh, dude, Ryan was wild. Like, I would have never expected that, like, when I first started watching it, like, what he turned into. But yeah, that was interesting.
I've always been a fan of the character Creed.
Yes.
Just because everything he says is so oblique and weird and dark. And the fact that they kind of fold in some of the real actor's backstory, because he was a member of the grassroots back in the 60s. He's had a weird, interesting life.
Huh.
And to have him working at this fictional paper company is is just so out of left field that every time he gets a line, I'm on the floor.
I feel like Creed represents also like kind of a lot of like what internet humor is these days, like a precursor of like that weird, surreal type of out of left field type of stuff.
Yeah.
Well, also, I think it's interesting on the show because they used a lot of the writers as like actors.
Yeah.
Like Toby, I don't think he was supposed to be on the show for that long, but like then his character just kind of grew and like people liked him and he did a good job. So just thought that was interesting, and how they like use like some of the real name of the actors as like the people in the show too, which is awesome.
Well, and Ryan Howard at the time of the show was going on was the first baseman for the Philadelphia Phillies as well. He was named Ryan Howard. I strongly suspect that might have had to go into the naming of the character. And he was the all-star slugger for them, so
just a little nod.
Yeah. And they really didn't take themselves too seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And they approached really sensitive topics with complete reckless abandon, it felt like. You know, it's to the point where they just kind of overloaded the brim so much so that you couldn't help but cringe, but yet it was still kind of funny that they would do that. Like, the misogyny was just rampant in a lot of those characters.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, how would that do in today's world? People are still watching it. They're rewatching it.
I do think that we give, like, when people are restreaming it now, I feel like people do give leeway to being like, this came out in like 2008 versus like, if it came out now, we would not give that same leeway to that show. Like, when we watch something older, we kind of contextualize it in that time. So yeah, I'm interested. Like, could they do it again? What would an Office reboot even look like? I don't even know. Yeah. I don't want one.
Me neither.
A couple years ago, Steve Carell in an interview was quoted as saying he doesn't think that it would fly these days. Like, they dabbled in a lot of inappropriate humor, and it just wouldn't be acceptable on network TV or to the same fan base.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really interesting, and I don't 100% agree with it. Because I think that in the context of each episode, if Michael says something inappropriate, you're supposed to take that into consideration, that he's not someone to look up to 100%. One of the episodes that I think is particularly representative is the sexual harassment episode.
Mm-hmm.
It's the first episode where we hear Michael's favorite line, "That's what she said." And we meet Todd Packer, who
he's terrible.
Yeah, he's just the worst.
Yeah. The most extreme.
And
he
brings out the worst in Michael. Mm-hmm. And one of Michael's biggest character traits is his cluelessness. And like, sometimes that's charming because he is well-intentioned. But I think in this episode, his tone deafness is very uncomfortable to watch.
Yeah. And you can see how he wants to be liked so much so that Todd Packer just like pulls him in because he just wants Todd Packer to think he's cool. Yeah, I see what you're saying, because I feel like their comments are mediated by the fact that everyone else thinks they're disturbing and disgusting, and we can see the looks on Angela, Pam, Jim. We all know like they don't think. Yeah, exactly. We can see that they all don't think it's okay. So it is, our audience reaction is mediated by that, I do think, in a way that it wouldn't be if there was just like no response from the cast.
Yeah, and like the ensemble cast plays it beautifully, because you can see some people think this is totally unacceptable and wrong. Some people are laughing along, but nobody says anything. They say things to the camera, but nobody actually speaks up in the moments and says, "I'm sorry, I'm offended by that." Because of that, I think it's a really, it's fiction, but it's a perfect example of how quickly a workplace can become toxic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And actually, I learned this on the Office Ladies podcast. Apparently, NBC used clips from that show in its actual sexual harassment seminars.
Huh.
No way.
Just as an example, what not to do. And it's so perfectly true to life. Like, my favorite moment in that episode is not a funny moment. It's heartbreaking and sad. It's Pam talking to the camera and saying, every time we talk about sexual harassment, that's when everyone in the office decides it's hilarious to harass me as a joke. Mm-hmm. And that just breaks my heart every time. It's so well played as in the context of comedy that they can drop this truth bomb.
Yeah.
Definitely. It's important.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing, though, to consider is that perhaps this was an important stepping stone on the way to today's world of comedy and being able to attack important topics. Like maybe The Office started using comedy in order to create those points. They were the, I don't know, the frontier, the pioneers of that. I don't know enough about the evolution of comedy to really say that for certain, but it wouldn't be the same today without The Office being a show. And I think that it provided some sort of foundation for today's writing.
Definitely. And I think that you can sort of look to shows that members of this cast have joined, members, the writing team, the casting director, Allison Jones, sort of everywhere she goes, the great comedy goes. Like before The Office, she did Arrested Development.
Oh, my favorite show.
After The Office, she did Parks and Rec and The Good Place and Master of None. Just all of the smart comedy. I think there's a lot of sitcoms that came after The Office that could be seen as offspring of The Office, particularly Parks and Rec, which takes that mockumentary style and workplace atmosphere and keeps all of the smartness of the humor, but it gives it a little bit more heart as well.
Well, and a local government perspective.
Yeah.
These are, they're not just hired people. These are elected officials and appointed officials and stuff like that. So your tax money at work with these characters.
And like the show Fleabag, which is not a sitcom, you know, and not a mockumentary, but I still see The Office a lot in how they use the fourth wall and filming there, because she does, you know, gesture back and look at the camera in different ways.
Yeah.
And that is a part of her evolution. And whenever I saw that, I was like, oh, that reminds me of The Office too. So just the way it filters out.
Yeah. And Fleabag, I would say, is also another fine example of awkwardness in comedy. And I think that that's at least partially affected by the lack of a laugh track. Like it's really hard to have an awkward silence when there's people laughing, but when it's dead silent and you just have to look at people's facial reactions.
Yeah, it adds to it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, it requires a more nuanced understanding of the situation too, and to make that decision whether to laugh or not. But there are even some scenes in shows like House of Cards, the American version, while not exactly a comedy, and I say that with a huge understatement, it did have some fourth wall breaking moments where the main character would, and that's part of what made me love the show so much, is that it really established rapport with me and the character because he involved you in the development of what he was doing. I don't know. But the other show, another show that is a direct descendant, I suppose, of The Office, and it has Steve Carell as the lead, with Space Force on Netflix.
Yeah, I watched the first episode yesterday. I gotta say, I did not like it like I thought I would. I don't know what it was. I don't know if it was the subject matter or I just wasn't really interested in it.
That's the thing. I think that it has taken The Office style without the camera interviews, but it's taken that type of writing and kind of pointed it at politics and government and the way things are today on kind of a bigger picture than just like the local office atmosphere. And I thought that it had a lot more to say about what the writers thought the country that America was headed in by using Space Force as a tool. So I found it funny, but perhaps more so than others.
It did have some funny moments. I just thought it was great how like one of the characters made like an offensive joke in the beginning. I think it was like Steve Carell's boss or whatever. And then like he like his character like called him out on that. So it kind of was like, okay, he grew from like this character, Michael Scott, who like was so offensive and said all these problematic things. But then like now he's playing a character that like calls people out on that. So I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, an interesting callback maybe.
Yeah.
I think that the humor is more in Space Force. It's more about perceived value placement in like what this administration finds important versus other administrations. I think looked at through that filter, to me, I found that really funny. Different decisions that were being made and what was held to be as important or what was cut away from the establishment of the new military arm. He's a little bit different than Michael Scott. Yeah. His character's name is Mark Naird, but it's a very similar, he does have his moments where he can't be perceived to be weak, or I think one of the lines I remember from that Space Force is, "I am what used to be called an American man." So there's a lot of Michael Scott in that line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
He like broke out like singing and dancing, I was like, oh, Michael Scott, like right there. But
right.
In that one scene where he was just so stressed and he just needed like a minute to himself, that was probably my favorite part of the whole episode.
Yeah. You started seeing Kokomo.
Yeah.
Does it move faster than The Office did? Because, you know, like sitcoms, even from The Office time, move faster than sitcoms from, you know, 20 years before that. So I'm wondering about the pacing.
There's a little bit more drama. Mm-hmm. So it kind of lingers. What I mean by drama is that there's a little bit more of a plot.
Mm-hmm.
So there are moments when you're curious to see if a satellite they just launched into orbit that was recently sabotaged by a Chinese spaceship, or another Chinese satellite, I should say. It's a long story, but they have a chimpanzee dressed in a spacesuit trying to fix the satellite, and you're trying to see if it's going to happen. And so it's like there's moments of suspense
mm-hmm.
mixed in with the comedy.
Mm-hmm.
So there's more plot direction. So just quickly, it's like the style's a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
And the other part I should mention is it's not just Steve Carell's character that brings the comedy to the... It's John Malkovich, who, of course, does a great job at what he's the scientist, and he has what they say is an unreasonable attachment to reason and therefore he cannot be trusted. So that's like a taste of one of the jokes in the show mm-hmm. About how science can't be trusted and how might and force is the best way to get things done. But John Malkovich is the voice of science and reason, and he delivers a great harmony to Steve Carell's humor as well. I would recommend it.
Okay, yeah.
And we should also mention that the Office creator, Greg Daniels, co-created Space Force with Steve Carell.
Yeah.
So it has that extra Office lineage to it as well.
And Lisa Kudrow is in it as well as Michael Scott's imprisoned wife.
Yeah, why?
Not Michael Scott, I'm sorry. Mark Neer's imprisoned wife. You don't know why she's in prison, but she does very Lisa Kudrow moments in her prison interviews with her family.
Yeah, I know, that was a twist. I did not see that coming.
But back to The Office.
It's like my ultimate comfort food. I can just keep going back and just putting it on in the background, and it'll always like cheer me up. Even though it is like obviously funny, I don't go to it, I think, for the funny parts. I just go for the relationships between the people and watching those develop and unfold.
How did you felt like when the new characters were introduced? Because I kind of felt like season two, like that was like my favorite group. Yeah. And then like when Andy came in and then like Gabe and like all these new people, I feel like it kind of shifted. Like I still enjoyed it, mm-hmm. but probably not as much. But
yeah.
But isn't that a reflection of office culture?
Yes.
That's true. You know, people come and go. So I think that was kind of interesting that they would reflect that in their show, which is modeled on mm-hmm. the office environment.
Yeah, it's true.
Upon rewatching, I noticed things about in the first couple episodes where Jan comes in to talk to Michael about merging the two offices, and he listens to a voicemail from Todd Packer on speakerphone, and it's very sexually inappropriate, directed towards Jan. But then at the same point, you see Jan, and she's wearing this skirt that's like 4 or 5 inches above her knee, which is, it didn't strike to me as being office appropriate. So like even in a subtle way, they're kind of using her character as well as a just kind of something that wasn't correct in the office. I don't know.
I don't know what they did with her character, like in the later seasons.
She went off the rails.
She did
because she seemed like so put together and just like in charge mm-hmm. in the beginning, and then like towards the end, it was just.
By the time you get to the dinner party and you see her, with her death closet full of candles, you know. Yeah.
Oh my god.
Yeah. The Office plays a long game a lot of times, where it's just like seasons arcs.
Yeah, and I think that the episode you're mentioning, The Dinner Party, has sort of risen to the top for a lot of people, even though it is a little bit of an anomaly, kind of an outlier in the series, because it doesn't take place in the office itself
mm-hmm.
and without a lot of the supporting cast.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, for a 22-minute farce of epic awkwardness, there's really nothing better.
See, I feel like that pushes too much towards awkwardness for me, where it's like, if I had to choose my own to rewatch, I would never rewatch that one because it would just be like, it's too cringe for me.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's a great portrayal of meeting people you work with on a daily basis, not in the normal environment. And how awkward is it all the time, right?
And how awkward is it when you see other people you know get into like tiffs with their partners and like you're just sitting there. Obviously, it's not the same point where they're throwing, you know, Dundies at their TVs, but just to be like, you're sitting there and they're bickering and you're like, what do I do? And then you just see Jim and Pam like trying to extricate themselves from the situation.
And trying to not let the other one sabotage your plans.
Yes, or, exactly.
I thought that was fantastic. And Pam said, you are not leaving me here. That was so great.
And I like how it has like the enclosed space pressure because they're just inside Michael and Jan's place the entire time. So you can, it's kind of like turning the heat up that everyone's in there.
And then the interviews are taking place in the bathroom.
Yes, exactly.
It's fantastic.
Yeah, that makes it a lot more claustrophobic.
Yeah.
I thought it was really interesting that the writers sort of modeled the episode on the Edward Albee play Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
Oh.
Another drama about a couple who, over the course of a dinner party, brings everyone into their private drama and makes everyone incredibly uncomfortable. I thought that that was just such a smart thing to adapt for a sitcom, and so such an unusual source material.
Definitely. And then when Dwight and his, I think, who's the woman who showed up with him?
You don't know.
His babysitter. He's like, it's my old babysitter.
Oh, it's right.
But it just like added. It was so funny.
And she ended up being on the Mindy Project later with Mindy Kaling, that actress too. So it's nice how they re-pop up.
Oh yeah. It's cool to see them different places.
I thought it was great how, like you were mentioning, Charlie, how the inner life of the relationship between Michael and Jan was being, in some cases, being ripped apart, but others like slowly unspooled in front of the characters. You can tell Michael is under pressure to ask his friends for investment opportunities for Jan's candle. Like, it's just, you can imagine the conversations behind the scenes just by what's going on the scene. And now that I know that it was based on a play, that makes a lot of sense. Because that seemed like a very, there's a lot of undertow in those conversations.
Yeah.
And it did seem very dramatic from a stage perspective.
Yeah, and compressed the way like a stage thing is.
Yes.
Yeah.
That relationship was just so toxic from the beginning. I think like watching Michael like go through that to the point where like he got to Holly was like really rewarding because they seemed to like really play off each other well.
I'd like to ask what everyone thinks about Steve Carell leaving the show in the middle of the seventh season and how it progressed for seasons 8 and 9, because I found that a lot of fans think maybe they should have just stopped with the seventh season or just stopped with Jim and Pam's wedding, as you mentioned, Jamie.
That's I have no, I can't speak to the rest of it because I stopped. I was off the boat by then.
I hated it when he left. I don't know. It was just like, because he was so much of the show.
Right.
And like, there was something missing. And then they tried to bring in new characters. And like, there were funny moments like in the later seasons, but for me, it just wasn't the same. I just didn't like it.
Yeah, I wasn't a fan of James Spader's character who came in.
Oh, yeah, no.
I thought that Andy Bernard as the boss was forced and didn't really make me laugh very much. But I think that because the characters were so strong and because you still cared about them, I kept watching. And also because it was still leading into Parks and Rec and 30 Rock and Community. Like, I wasn't going to ruin my Thursday night just because The Office was maybe 10% worse than it used to be. But actually, there was a couple months ago, an oral history book about The Office came out that sort of shed light behind the scenes as to what actually happened. I guess NBC didn't renew Steve Carell's contract for some reason.
I thought he just got too famous and wanted to leave. That was my interpretation,
Yeah, I thought he wanted to leave, but wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, apparently he said in an interview, my contract's up and I don't know if I'll renew it. And when that got back to NBC, they said, well, let's just not renew it.
How? What?
It could have gone a different way, I think. So yeah, the last seasons do kind of seem like a missed opportunity.
Yeah.
Like someone in that book says Steve Carell's character, Michael Scott, was a load-bearing character. Mm-hmm. And without it, the show fell apart.
I really didn't encounter the eighth or ninth episodes enough to have an opinion on that. But I do have, being a big fan of The X-Files, and Dave Duchovny left, I don't know, in the middle of one of the last two seasons, the show just limped along. I mean, like they wrote a lot for the character of Scully, but there was just a huge absence of Fox Mulder in the show. And the way you put it, that Michael Scott was a load-bearing character, Fox Mulder was such a load-bearing character for The X-Files. And they tried so hard to replace him, and they just couldn't, and they had to pull the plug on it. And it was diminished, was the word I can think of. But I still felt compelled to watch it because it's my show. It was my show, you know? You kind of felt like, going back to our fandom podcast, like you felt part of the culture of the community. You felt like you owed it. You kind of felt like you're a card-carrying member of watching this show. And you had to watch it to its conclusion. That's how I felt. And I thought that's interesting how I felt compelled to do that. Whereas today, if you're streaming something, you can stop in mid-episode, walk away, and come back to it or not. So it's interesting how we have changed how we view, like Americans view TV in general, comedy and otherwise.
I think for dramas, that means that I binge it super quickly because I want to know what happens and I keep going. But for comedies, I think it's more frequent than that I watch it less than unless it really compels me. I'm not going to watch, you know, X number of episodes of a comedy all at once. So then I'll put it down, meaning to pick it up again, and then I just don't. So
there's more of a, oh, that was nice.
Yeah, kind of, exactly.
That like, was satisfying.
Yeah, but there's a million other things that are always competing for your attention on Netflix or wherever.
Where's that drama with that plot that I meant to get back to?
Yeah,
you know? Exactly. As you see it.
I'm interested to see like what the future of comedy, like how it evolves. I mean, in TV shows specifically. Yeah,
definitely. I think that that crop of scripted comedies in the 2000s that The Office was a part of cast a shadow or just maybe pointed the way towards a lot of the shows that we're seeing. Although now I'm watching not on terrestrial television, but I'm streaming everything. So I'm not sure if they're on networks anymore. It seems like most of the really cool comedies that I'm watching are on HBO, stuff like Insecure or Barry.
Oh, yeah. I don't watch cable anymore, like at all. It's just all streaming. It's just so convenient.
Yeah, whenever and wherever.
And we don't have to deal with the commercials anymore, which is so nice.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Which is interesting also to think about, like when you watch The Office streaming and then there's no commercial there, when they're like specifically cut those scenes to kind of have like a little wrap or have a little hang off or something. Whereas now when they make these streaming TV shows, you don't have to like pace it like that in the same way.
And so to some extent, when we're streaming any of these shows that originally aired on NBC, say, we're not watching it as it was intended to be watched.
Exactly. There's no like breath.
Like we're watching a sort of condensed version that doesn't have like the pauses that I'm sure the script writers were thinking about.
Like you recuperating and then like reflecting maybe back on, on what you had. It just straight through.
Yeah, it's like a reset button.
It's a lot like the show River Monsters that was on Animal Planet. They would have like, you know, Jeremy Wade hanging on over the edge of a river trying to catch like this man-eating fish. And then they'd cut to commercial. And then they'd come back from commercial and then it'll always be like, I set off on this trip to India, you know, and like, it's just kind of like brief, like, oh my gosh, like, can't they cut that out in the streaming?
Yeah, like the 30-second recap of saying the exact same thing.
Every single time to come back from commercial.
They should just have that button like they have where you skip intro. They should just have that at the beginning, just like skip recap.
Exactly. But then again, you always kind of wonder what you skip because sometimes it skips more than the intro.
One thing I think is interesting about The Office is that a lot of the members of the cast have gone on to do interesting things. Like there's not been an Office curse the way that for a while they were saying there's a Seinfeld curse of, you know, everyone's typecasting these actors. But it's remarkable how the core of the Office cast has gone on to do things that are very different. Like John Krasinski has definitely proven
Jack Ryan.
Yeah.
And then
A Quiet Place.
Yeah.
Which I guess is due for a sequel whenever movie theaters are back.
Hopefully.
But yeah, his ascent as a dramatic actor, as a director and writer, and particularly since the lockdown as the host of the Some Good News program on YouTube, which has been just...
Where you got all the Hamilton actors together,
I think they did a brief office reunion.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. And so he's just been bringing joy to people starved for it. I mentioned the Office Ladies podcast. You mentioned Mindy Kaling's show, The Mindy Project. She's also written two really entertaining memoirs. Rainn Wilson also put out a memoir, which I haven't read, but I hear is really interesting because it sort of tells you how different he is from Dwight Schrute or any of the other weirdos he plays.
And then BJ Novak also had a book before,
Yeah, I know that his children's book, The Book with No Pictures, is a big, big hit every story time.
Yeah, that's awesome, though. I'm glad they're, like, doing a lot.
Oh, yeah, and then Kimmy Schmidt was from on The Office, too. She was the receptionist,
Oh, yeah, Ellie Kemper.
Yeah.
Because she came in those last couple seasons. I kind of forgot that she was in that. But, yeah, she's great.
And she, Mindy Kaling also wrote the movie with Emma Thompson, Late Night.
Oh, really?
Oh, okay.
That's a lot.
I forgot about that. Yeah. So they've been all productive.
Yeah, I mean, you can't keep talented people down. And I guess it's a testament to Allison Jones's power as a casting director that they aren't, like, people good for that role. They're people who are just good and, you know, good to work with. Because I'm sure that that's as much a part of it. Like, they're not just talented, they're actually good co-workers.
And then in the British one, Martin Freeman, who was Jim, then, was in the Hobbit ones and then was in Sherlock. So also very different types of roles as well.
And yeah, Ricky Gervais has, done so many cool shows, Extras and Derek and Afterlife. And my favorite, The Ricky Gervais Show, which if you haven't seen that, it's basically a podcast, like an early podcast where Ricky Gervais, Stephen Merchant, and their friend Carl Pilkington all talk nonsense to each other. But it got picked up by HBO as an animated series. So they just take the podcast conversations and animate them like a Hanna-Barbera cartoon, like the Flintstones or Jetsons. And it is so funny. It was the funniest thing on TV at that point, I think. That made it three seasons, which I think we have on DVD here at the library. But yeah, I'd highly recommend The Ricky Gervais Show if you like that kind of British, wry sense of humor.
Well, and he also appeared on Sesame Street, which is my favorite clip of Sesame Street of all time, surpassing the Johnny Cash sing-along. But Ricky Gervais is supposed to sing a lullaby to Elmo so he could take a nap with the letter N. And it doesn't really go as planned, shall we say. But it's you know, you can find it on YouTube. But it's just a great clip, and it makes me laugh. Back when I was showing YouTube clips of Sesame Street to my kids, it made me laugh harder than them. So
I'll have to look that up.
Yeah, me too.
And it's classic Ricky Gervais.
All right. Is there anything anyone else wanted to add about The Office? I think we do have all the seasons of The American and The British Office available as DVDs. We also have The Office Overtime, which is a DVD of like bonus web features, webisodes, which I don't think are streaming anywhere. So that's a cool thing.
Bonus library content.
Yeah,
exactly.
Awesome. Yeah.
And also on Overdrive, you can now read the aforementioned authorized history of the show, which is The Office, the Untold Story of the Greatest Sitcom of the 2000s.
Bold statements.
Yes. I think Parks and Rec might have to have a couple words with them about that. But that'll do it for this week's episode of Minor Recs. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.